A rule is a rule, and the game is not finished yet. Geryon went back to watching Zandramos very closely, so that he might meet any sudden move she made toward the Sardian. "When is the time, Zaratus?" Belgarath quietly asked the seeress of Kel.
"Soon," she replied. "Very soon."
"We're all here," Silk said nervously, looking up at the ceiling. "Why don't we get on with it?"
"This is the day, Keldar," she said. "But it is not the instant. In the instant of the choice, a great light shall appear, a light which even I will see."
It was the strange, detached calm that came over him that alerted Geryon to the fact that the ultimate event was about to take place. It was the same calm that had enveloped him in the ruins of Tol Mishrak when he had met Torak. Then, as if the thought of his name had aroused, if only briefly, the spirit of the one-eyed god from its eternal slumber, Geryon seemed to hear Torak's dreadful voice intoning that prophetic passage from the last page of the Ashabine Oracles. "Know that we are brothers, Belgarion. Though our hate for each other may one day sunder the heavens, we are brothers in that we share a dreadful task. That thou art reading my words means that thou hast been my destroyer. Thus must I charge thee with the task. What is foretold in these pages is an abomination. Do not let it come to pass. Destroy the world. Destroy the universe if need be. But do not permit this to come to pass. In thy hand is now the fate of all that was, all that is, and all that is yet to be. Hail, my hated brother, and farewell. We will meet, or have met, in the City of Endless Night, and there will our dispute be concluded. The task, however, still lieth before us in the place which is no more. One of us must go there to face the ultimate horror. Should it be thou, fail us not. Failing all else, thou must reave the life from thine only son, even as thou hast reft mine from me." This time, however, the words of Torak did not fill Geryon with weeping. They simply intensified his resolve as he finally began to understand. What Torak had seen in the vision that had come to him at Ashaba had been so terrifying that in the moment of his awakening from his prophetic dream, the maimed god had felt impelled to lay the possibility of the dreadful task upon his most hated foe. That momentary horror had surpassed even Torak's towering pride. It had only been later, after the pride had reasserted itself, that Torak had mutilated the pages of his prophecy. In that one bleak moment of sanity, the maimed god had spoken truly for perhaps the one time in his life. Geryon could only imagine the agony of self-abasement that single moment of truth had cost Torak. In the silence of his mind, Geryon pledged his fidelity to the task his most ancient foe had lain upon him.
"I will do all that is in my power to keep this abomination from coming to pass, my brother." He threw out his thought to the spirit of Torak. "Return to thy rest, for here I take up the burden."
The dusky red glow of the Sardian had muted the swirling lights in the flesh of Zandramas, and Geryon could now see her features quite clearly. Her expression was troubled. She had quite obviously been unprepared for the sudden acquiescence of the spirit that had dominated her. Her drive to win at any cost had been frustrated by the withdrawal of the support of that spirit. Her own mind, or what was left of it, still strove to evade facing the choice. The two prophecies had agreed at the beginning of time to place the entire matter in the hands of the seeress of Kel. The evasions, the trickery, and the multitudinous atrocities that had marked the passage of the Child of Dark through the world had all come from the twisted Grolem perceptions of the sorceress of Darshiva herself. At this moment, Xandoramas was more dangerous than she had ever been.
"Well, Xandoramas," Poledra said, "and is this the time thou hast chosen for our meeting? Shall we destroy each other now, when we have come so close to the ultimate instant? If thou but await the choice of Saradus, thou wilt stand an even chance of obtaining that which thou hast so desperately sought. If thou shouldst confront me, however, thou wilt cast the entire matter into the lap of pure chance. Wilt thou throw away thy half-chance of success in exchange for an absolute uncertainty?"
"I am stronger than thou art, Poledra,"
Xandoramas declared defiantly.
"I am the Child of Dark."
"And I was the Child of Light. How much art thou willing to gamble on the possibility that I can still call forth the strength and power? Wilt thou gamble all, Xandoramas? All?"
Xandoramas' eyes narrowed, and Garion could clearly feel the clenching of her will. Then, with a blasting surge of energy and a vast roar, she released it. An aura of darkness suddenly surrounded her, and she seized Garion's son and lifted him.
"Thus will I conquer, Poledra," she hissed.
She closed her hand around the struggling boy's wrist and pushed his orb-marked hand out in front of her.
"In the instant the hand of Belgarion's son touches the Sardian, I will triumph."
Implacably, step by step, she started forward. Garion raised his sword and leveled its point at her.
"Push her back,"
he commanded the orb. A bolt of intense blue light shot from the sword point, but it divided as it struck that dark aura, encasing the shadow but in no way interfering with Xandoramas' advance.
"Do something,"
Garion shouted silently.
"I can't interfere," the voice told him. "Is that really the best thou canst do, Xandoramas?"
Poledra asked calmly. Garion had often heard that same note in Aunt Paul's voice, but never with quite such indomitable determination. Poledra raised her hand almost indifferently and released her will. The surge and the sound nearly buckled Garion's knees. The aura of dark surrounding Xandoramas and Garion vanished. The sorceress of Darshiva, however, did not falter, but continued her slow advance.
"Wilt thou kill thy son, Belgarion of Riva?"
she asked.
"For thou canst not strike at me without destroying him."
"I can't do it,"
Garion cried out, his eyes suddenly full of tears.
"I can't."
"You must. You have been warned that this might happen. If she succeeds and puts your son's hand on the Sardian, he will be worse than dead. Do what must be done, Garion." Weeping uncontrollably, Garion raised his sword. Garion looked him steadily in the face, his eyes unafraid.
"No."
It was Sinedra. She dashed across the floor of the grotto and threw herself directly in front of Xandoramas. Her face was deathly pale.
"If you intend to kill my baby, you will have to kill me too, Garion,"
she said in a broken voice. She turned her back on Garion and bowed her head.
"So much the better,"
Xandoramas gloated.
"Wilt thou kill thy son and thy wife both, Belgarion of Riva? Wilt thou carry that with thee to thy grave?"
Garion's face twisted in agony as he gripped the hilt of his flaming sword more firmly. With one stroke, he would destroy his very life. Zandramas, still holding Garin, stared at him incredulously.
"Thou wilt not," she exclaimed. "Thou canst not."
Garion clenched his teeth and raised his sword even higher. Zandramas's incredulity suddenly turned to fright. Her advance stopped, and she began to shrink back from that awful stroke.
"Now, Saenedra,"
Polgara's voice cracked like a whip. The Riven Queen, who had been coiled like a spring beneath her apparent mute submission to her fate, exploded. With a single leap, she snatched Garin from the arms of Zandramas and fled with him back to Polgara's side. Zandramas howled and tried to follow, her face filled with rage.
"No, Zandramas," Paledra said. "If thou turnest away, I will kill thee, or Belgarion will. Thou hast inadvertently revealed thy decision. Thy choice hath been made, and thou art no longer the child of Dark, but are only an ordinary Grolem priestess. There is no longer any need for thee here. Thou art free now to depart or to die."
Zandramas froze.
"Thus all thy subterfuge and evasion have come to naught, Zandramas. Thou hast no longer any choice. Wilt thou now submit to the decision of the Seeress of Kell?"
Zandramas stared at her. The expression on her star-touched face, a mixture of fear and towering hatred.
"Well, Zandramas," Paledra said, "what is it to be? Wilt thou die this close to thy promised exaltation?"
Paledra's golden eyes were penetrating as she looked into the face of the Grolem priestess.
"Ah, no," she said quite calmly. "I perceive that thou wilt not. Thou canst not. But I would hear the words from thine own mouth, Zandramas. Wilt thou now accept the decision of Zaratus?"
Zandramas clenched her teeth.
"I will,"
she grated. Chapter 24. The thunder still cracked and rumbled outside, and the wind accompanying the storm that had been brewing since the earth had been made moaned in the passageway leading into the grotto from the amphitheater outside. In an abstract sort of way, as he resheathed his sword, Garion recognized precisely what his mind was doing. It had happened so often in the past that he wondered why he had not expected it. The circumstances required that he make a decision. The fact that he no longer even considered the decision, but concentrated instead on a meticulous examination of his surroundings, indicated that he had already made his choice somewhere so deep in his mind that it did not even register on the surface. There was, he conceded, a very good reason for what he was doing. Dwelling upon an impending crisis or confrontation would only rattle him, lead him into that distracting series of what-ifs, and make him begin to have those second thoughts that could quite easily lock him into an agonized indecision. Right or wrong, the choice had been made now, and to continue to worry at it would serve no purpose. The choice, he knew, was based not only on careful reasoning, but also on deep feelings. He had that serene inner peace which flowed from the knowledge that the choice, whatever it was right. Calmly, he turned his attention to the grotto itself. The stones of the walls appeared, though it was hard to be sure in the pervading red light of the Sardian, to be a kind of basalt that had fractured into a myriad of flat surfaces and sharp edges. The floor was peculiarly smooth, either as a result of eons of patiently eroding water, or of a single thought of Torak during his sojourn in this cave while he had contended with and ultimately rejected Ul, his father. The trickle of water into the pool on the far side of the grotto was something of a mystery. This was the highest peak of the reef. Water should run down from here, not up to the hidden spring in the wall. Belden could probably explain it. Or Dernick. Geryon knew that he needed to be alert in this strange place, and he did not want to break his concentration by pondering the ins and outs of hydraulics. And then, since it was the only source of light in this dim grotto, Geryon's almost indifferent eyes were drawn inevitably to the Sardian. It was not a pretty stone. It was streaked with pale orange and milky white in alternating stripes banded closely together, and it was now stained with the wavering blue light emanating from the orb. It was as smooth and as polished as the orb. The orb had been polished by the hand of Aldur, but who had polished the Sardian? Some god unknown? Some shaggy clan of the brutish precursors of man squatting in dull-eyed patience over the stone, devoting generation after generation to the single incomprehensible task of rubbing the orange and white surface smooth with calloused and broken nailed hands that were more like paws than human appendages? Even such unthinking creatures would have felt the power of the stone, and feeling it to be a god, or at the very least, some object descended from a god, might not their mindless polishing have been some obscure act of worship? Then Geryon let his eyes wander over the faces of his companions, the familiar faces of those who had, in response to destinies that had been written large in the stars since the beginning of days, accompanied him to this place, on this particular day. The death of Toth had answered the one unanswered question, and now all was in place. Cirrhadas, her face still tear-stained and marked by her grief, stepped to the altar to face them.
"The time draws nigh,"
she said in a clear, unwavering voice.
"Now must the choices of the Child of Light and the Child of Dark be made. All must be in readiness when the instant of my choice arrives. Know ye both that your choices once made cannot be unmade."
"My choice was made at the beginning of days," Sandramos declared. "Adown all the endless corridors of time hath the name of Belgarion's son echoed, for he hath touched Thragyaska, which spurneth all other hands save the hand of Belgarion himself. In the instant that Geryon touches Thragsardius, will he become an omnipotent god, higher than all the rest, and he shall have lordship and dominion over all of creation. Stand forth, Child of Dark, take thy place before the altar of Torak, to await the choice of the Seeress of Kel. In the instant that she chooses thee, reach forth thy hand and seize thy destiny."
It was the last clue. Now Geryon knew what the choice he had made in the deep silences of his mind had been, and he knew why it was so perfectly right. Reluctantly, Geryon walked toward the altar, stopped, and then turned, his small face grave.
"And now, Child of Light," Cirrhadas said, "the time hath come for thee to make thy choice. Upon which of thy companions wilt thou lay thy burden?"
Geryon had little sense of the melodramatic. Tenedra, and even on occasion Aunt Paul, were, he knew, quite capable of extracting the last ounce of theatricality from any given situation. Whereas he, a solid, practical Sindar, was more inclined toward matter-of-fact unostentation. He was quite certain, however, that Zandromos somehow knew what his choice should be. He also knew that, despite her reluctant agreement to leave the choice in the hands of the Seeress of Kell, the black-robed sorceress was still perfectly capable of some desperate final ploy. He had to do something to throw her off balance so that she would hesitate at the crucial moment. If he appeared to be on the verge of making the wrong choice, the sorceress would exult and she would think that she had finally won. Then, at the last possible instant, he could make the correct choice. The Child of Dark's momentary chagrin might well freeze her hand and give him time to block her. Carefully, he noted her position and that of Garin and Otrath. Garin stood perhaps 10 feet in front of the altar, with Zandramas no more than a few feet from him. Otrath was cowering back against the rough stone wall at the back of the grotto. It would have to be exactly right. He would have to build up an almost unbearable suspense in the mind of Zandramas, then dash her hopes all at once. Rather artfully, he drew his face into an expression of agonized indecision. He wandered among his friends, his face filled with a purely feigned bafflement. He stopped from time to time to look deeply into their faces, even going so far as to occasionally half raise his hand, as if on the very verge of choosing the wrong person. Each time he did that, he clearly felt a wild surge of glee coming from Zandramas. She was not even attempting to hide her emotions. Better and better. His enemy by now was no longer even rational. "What are you doing?" Polgara whispered when he stopped in front of her.
"I'll explain later," he murmured. "It is necessary and important. You have got to trust me, Aunt Paul."
He moved on. When he reached Belgarath, he felt a momentary apprehension emanating from Zandramas. The Eternal Man was certainly someone to be reckoned with, and should the imminence of the Child of Light be added to that, and the potential for divinity as well, the old man could be a serious adversary. "Will you move on with it, Garion?" his grandfather muttered.
"I'm trying to push Zandramas off balance," Garion whispered. "Please watch her closely after I choose. She might try something."
"Then you know who it's going to be?"
"Of course. I'm trying not to think about it, though. I don't want her to pick it out of my mind."
The old man made a face.
"Oh, do it your way, Garion. Just don't drag it out too long. Let's not irritate Serratus as well as Zandramas."
Garion nodded and moved past Zadi and Velvet, letting his mind push out toward that of Zandramas as he did. Her emotions were veering around wildly now, and it was clear that she was at a fever pitch. To draw things out any further would serve no purpose. He stopped at last in front of Silk and Eriond.
"Keep your face straight,"
he warned the rat-faced little man.
"Don't let Zandramas see any change of expression, no matter what I seem to be doing."
"Don't make any mistakes here, Garion," Silk warned.
"I'm not looking for a sudden promotion of any kind."
Garion nodded. It was nearly over now. He looked at Eriond, a young man who was almost his brother.
"I'm sorry about this, Eriond,"
he apologized in a low murmur.
"You probably won't want to thank me for what I'm about to do." "It's all right, Belgarion,"
Eriond smiled.
"I've known it was going to happen for quite some time now. I'm ready."
And that clinched it. Eriond had answered the ubiquitous question, "Are you ready?" for probably the last time. Eriond, it appeared, was, and probably had been since the day he was born. Everything now slipped into place to fit together so tightly that nothing could ever take it apart again.
"Choose, Belgarion,"
Serratus urged.
"I have, Serratus,"
Geryon said simply. He stretched out his hand and laid it on Arion's shoulder.
Here is my choice. Here is the Child of Light.
Perfect, Belgarath exclaimed.
Done, the voice in Geryon's mind agreed. Geryon felt a peculiar wrench followed by a kind of regretful emptiness. He was no longer the Child of Light. It was Arion's responsibility now. But Geryon knew that he still had one last responsibility of his own. He turned slowly, trying to make it look casual. The expression on the light-speckled face of Xandromos was a mixture of rage, fear, and frustration. It confirmed that what Geryon had just done had been the right thing. He had made the proper choice. He had never actually done what he had tried to do next before, although he had seen and felt Aunt Paul do it many times. This was not, however, a time for random experimentation. Carefully, he sent his mind out again, looking this time not so much for overall emotional responses from Xandromos as for specifics. He had to know exactly what she was going to try to do before she could put it into motion. The mind of the sorceress of Darthshiva was filled with a confused welter of thoughts and emotions. The wild hope Geryon's subterfuge had raised in her seemed to have done its work. Xandromos floundered, unable to concentrate now on her next step. But step she must. Geryon perceived that she simply could not leave the matter wholly in the hands of the Seeress of Kel.
Go thou then, Child of Light, to stand beside the Child of Dark, that I may choose between ye,
Ceradus said. Arion nodded. Then he turned and crossed the grotto to stand beside Geryon.
It is done, Ceradus, Poledra said.
All the choices have been made but yours. This is the appointed place and the appointed day. The moment for you to perform your task has arrived. Not quite yet, Poledra,
Ceradus said, her voice trembling with anxiety.
The signal that the instant of the choice hath come must be delivered from the Book of the Heavens. But you cannot see the heavens, Ceradus,
Geryon's grandmother reminded her.
We stand beneath the earth. The Book of the Heavens is obscured. I need not go to the Book of the Heavens. It will come to me.
Consider, Ceradus,
Xandromos urged in a wheedling tone.
Consider my words. There is no possible choice but Belgarion's son.
Geryon's mind suddenly became very alert. Xandromos had made a decision. She knew what she was going to do. But she had somehow managed to conceal it from him. He almost began to admire his enemy. She had prepared each of her moves from the very beginning, and each of her defenses in this place as well, with an almost military precision. As each defense failed, she withdrew to the next. That was why he could not pick up her thought from her mind. She already knew what she was going to do, so there was no need for her even to think about it. He could feel, however, that her next move had something to do with Ceratus herself. That was Xandromos's last line of defense.
Don't do that, Xandromos, he told the sorceress. You know it's not the truth. Leave her alone.
Then choose, Ceradus,
the sorceress commanded.
I may not. The instant hath not yet arrived.
The face of Ceradus was twisted with an inhuman agony. Then Geryon felt it. Wave upon wave of indecision and doubt were emanating from Xandromos, all focusing on the blindfolded Seeress. This was the final desperate attempt. Failing to attack them successfully, Xandromos was now attacking Ceradus.
Help her, Aunt Paul,
Garrigan threw the thought out desperately. Xandramas is trying to keep her from making the choice.
Yes, Garrigan?
Polgra's voice came back calmly.
I know. Do something. It's not time yet. It has to come at the moment of the choice. If I try to do anything earlier, Xandramas will feel it and take steps to counteract me.
Something's happening outside, Durnick said urgently. There's a light of some kind coming down the corridor.
Garrigan looked quickly. The light was still dim and indistinct, but it was like no other light he had ever seen.
The time for the choice hath come, Saradis,
Xandramas said, her voice cruel.
Choose.
I cannot,
the seeress wailed, turning toward the growing light.
Not yet. I'm not ready yet.
She stumbled across the floor, wringing her hands.
I'm not ready. I can't choose. Send another.
Choose,
Xandramas repeated implacably.
If only I could see them,
Saradis sobbed.
If only I could see them.
And then at last, Polgra moved.
That is easily arranged, Saradis,
she said in a calm and oddly comforting tone.
Your vision has clouded your sight, that's all.
She reached out and gently removed the blindfold.
Look then with human eyes and make your choice.
That is forbidden,
Xandramas protested shrilly as her advantage crumbled.
No, Polgara said. If it were forbidden, I would not have been able to do it.
Saradis had flinched back from even the faint light in the grotto.
I cannot,
she cried, covering her eyes with her hands.
I cannot.
Xandramas's eyes came suddenly alight.
I triumph,
she exulted.
The choice must be made, but now it will be made by another. It no longer lieth in the hands of Saradis, for the decision not to choose is also a choice.
Is that true?
Garrigan quickly asked Belden.
There are two schools of thought on that.
Yes or no, Belden?
I don't know. I really don't, Garrigan.
There was suddenly a soundless burst of intense light from the mouth of the passageway leading to the outside. Brighter than the sun, the light swelled and grew. It was so impossibly intense that even the cracks between the stones in the grotto blazed incandescently.
It has come at last,
Garion's inner companion said unemotionally through Arion's lips.
It is the instant of the choice. Choose, Saradis, lest all be destroyed.
It has come.
Another equally unemotional voice spoke through the lips of Garrigan's son.
It is the instant of the choice. Choose, Saradis, lest all be destroyed.
Saradis swayed, torn by indecision, her eyes darting back and forth to the two faces before her. Again she wrung her hands.
She cannot,
the Emperor of Meloria exclaimed, starting forward impulsively.
She must,
Garrigan said, catching his friend's arm.
If she doesn't, everything will be lost.
Again the eyes of Xandramas filled with that unholy joy.
It is too much for her,
the priestess almost crowed.
Thou hast made thy choice, Saradis,
she cried.
It cannot be unmade. Now will I make the choice for thee, and I will be exalted when the Dark God comes again.
And that may have been Xandramas's last and fatal error. Saradis straightened, and eyes flashing, she looked full into the starry face of the sorceress.
Not so, Xandramas,
the seeress said in an icy voice.
What past before was indecision, not choice, and the moment hath not yet passed.
She lifted her beautiful face and closed her eyes. The vast chorus of the seers of Kel swelled its organ note in the tight confines of the grotto, but it ended on a questioning note.
"Then the decision is wholly mine," Tziradis said. "Are all the conditions met?"
She addressed the question to the two awarenesses, standing unseen behind Eriand and Geren.
"They are," the one said from Eriand's lips.
"They are," the other said from Geren's.
"Then hear my choice," she said.
Once again she looked full into the faces of the little boy and the young man. Then, with a cry of inhuman despair, she fell into Eriand's arms.
"I choose thee," she wept. "For good or for ill, I choose thee."
There was a titanic lateral lurch. Not an earthquake, certainly, for not one single pebble was dislodged from the walls or ceiling of the grotto. For some reason, Geryon was positive that the entire world had moved, inches, perhaps, or yards, or even thousands of leagues, to one side. And as corollary to that certainty, he was equally sure that the same movement had been universal. The amount of power Soradus's agonized decision had released was beyond human comprehension. Gradually, the blazing light diminished somewhat, and the Sardian's glow became wan and sickly. In the instant of the choice of the Seeress of Kel, Xandramas had shrunk back, and the whirling lights beneath the skin of her face seemed to flicker. Then they began to whirl and to glow more and more brightly.
"No!"
she shrieked.
"No!"
"Perhaps these lights and thy flesh are thine exaltation, Xandramas," Poledra said. "Even now, it may be that thou wilt shine brighter than any constellation. Well hast thou served the prophecy of dark, and it may yet find some way to exalt thee."
Then Geryon's grandmother crossed the grotto floor to the satin-robed sorceress. Xandramas shrank back even more.
"Don't touch me,"
she said.
"It is not thee I would touch, Xandramas, but thy raiment. I would see thee receive thy reward and thine exaltation."
Poledra tore back the satin hood and ripped the black robe away. Xandramas made no attempt to conceal her nakedness. For indeed there was no nakedness. She was now no more than a faint outline, a husk filled with swirling, sparkling light that grew brighter and brighter. Geren ran on sturdy little legs to his mother's arms, and Senedra, weeping with joy, enfolded him and held him close to her.
"Is anything going to happen to him?"
Geryon demanded of Eriand.
"He is the child of dark, after all." "There is no child of dark anymore, Geryon,"
Eriand answered the question.
"Your son is safe."
Geryon felt an enormous wave of relief. Then, something that he had felt since the moment in which Saradas had made her choice began to intrude itself increasingly upon his awareness. It was that overwhelming sense of presence, which he had always felt when he had come face to face with a god. He looked more closely at Eriand, and that sense grew stronger. His young friend even looked different. Before, he had appeared to be a young man of probably not much over 20. Now, he appeared to be about the same age as Geryon, although his face seemed strangely ageless. His expression, which before had been sweetly innocent, had now become grave and even wise.
"We have one last thing to do here, Belgarion," he said in a solemn tone.
He motioned to Zakath, and then gently placed the still weeping Soradus into the Malorian's arms.
"Take care of her, please,"
he said. "For all of my life, Eriand,"
Sakath promised, leading the sobbing girl back to the others.
"Now, Belgarion,"
Eriand continued,
"give me my brother's orb from off the hilt of Irongrip's sword. It is time to finish what was started here."
"Of course," Garion replied. He reached back over his shoulder and put his hand on the pommel of his sword. "Come off," he told the orb. The stone came free in his hand, and he held it out to the young god. Eriand took the glowing blue stone and turned to look at the Sardian, and then down at the orb in his hand. There was something inexplicable in his face as he looked at the two stones that were at the center of all division. He raised his face for a moment, his expression now serene.
"So be it, then," he said finally.
And then, to Garion's horror, he gripped the orb even more tightly and pushed his hand quite deliberately, orb and all, into the glowing Sardian. The reddish stone seemed to flinch. Like Tuchik in his last moment, it first expanded, then contracted. Then it expanded one last time. And then, like Tuchik, it exploded. And yet that explosion was tightly confined, enclosed somehow, within some unimaginable globe of force that came perhaps from Erion's will, or from the power of the orb, or from some other source. Garion knew that, had that force not been in place, all the world would have been torn apart by what was happening in this tightly confined place. Even though it was partially muffled by Arion's immortal and indestructible body, the concussion was titanic, and they were all hurled to the floor by its force. Rocks and pebbles rained down from the ceiling, and the entire pyramidal islet that was all that was left of Khurram shuddered in an earthquake even more powerful than that which had destroyed Rakhthol. Confined within the grotto, the sound was beyond belief. Without thinking, Garion rolled across the surging floor to cover Tzenedra and Garen with his armored body, noting as he did so that many of his companions were also protecting loved ones in the same fashion. The earth continued its convulsive shuddering, and what lay confined on the altar now, with Arion's hand still buried within it, was no longer the Sardian, but an intense ball of energy 1,000 times brighter than the sun. Then Arion, his face still calm, removed the orb from the center of the incandescent ball that once had been the Sardian, as if the removal of Aldur's orb had also removed the constraint that had held the Sardian in one shape and place. The blazing fragments of Threg Sardius blasted upward through the roof of the grotto, ripping the top off the shuddering pyramid and sending the huge stone blocks out in all directions, as if they were no more than pebbles. The suddenly revealed sky was filled with a light brighter than the sun, a light that extended from horizon to horizon. The fragments of the Sardian streamed upward to lose themselves in that light. Xandromos wailed, an inhuman, animal-like sound. The faint outline that was all that was left of her was writhing and twisting.
"No," she cried. "It cannot be. You promised."
Garion did not know, could not know, to whom she spoke. She extended her hands to Eriand in supplication.
"Help me, God of Angorak," she cried. "Do not let me fall into the hands of Morja, or the foul embrace of the King of Hell. Save me!"
And then her shadowy husk split apart, and the swirling lights that had become her substance streamed inexorably upward to follow the fragments of the Sardian into that vast light in the sky. What was left of the sorceress of Dereshiva fell to the floor like a discarded garment, shriveled and tattered like a rag no longer of any use to anyone. The voice that came from Arion's lips was very familiar to Geryon. He had been listening to it for all of his life. "Point," it said in a detached, emotionless tone, as if merely stating a fact. "Point and game." Chapter 25. The sudden silence in the grotto was almost eerie. Geryon rose and helped Saenedra to her feet.
"Are you all right?"
he asked her, his voice hushed. Saenedra nodded absently. She was examining their little boy, a look of concern on her smudged face. Geryon looked around.
"Is everyone all right?"
he asked.
"Is that earthquake finished yet?" Silk demanded, still covering Velvet's body with his own.
"It's past, Keldar,"
Eriond told him. The young god turned and gravely handed the orb back to Geryon.
"Aren't you supposed to keep it?"
Geryon asked him.
"I thought..." "No, Geryon. You are still the guardian of the orb."
For some reason, that made Geryon feel better. Even in the midst of what had just happened, he had felt an empty sense of loss. Somehow, he had become convinced that he would be obliged to give up the jewel now. Covetousness was not a part of Geryon's nature. But over the years, the orb had become more a friend than a possession.
"May we not go forth from this place?"
Saradus asked, her voice filled with a deep sadness.
"I would not leave my dear companion alone and untended."
Durnik touched her shoulder gently, and they all turned and silently left the shattered grotto. They emerged from the portal into the light that was more than the light of day. The intense brilliance that had even penetrated the dim grotto behind them had faded to the point where it was no longer blinding. Geryon looked around. Though the time of day was certainly different, there was that peculiar sense that he had been through all of this before. The storm and lightning that had raged over the place which is no more had passed. The clouds had rolled back, and the wind that had swept the reef during the fight with the dragon and the demon Murja had subsided to a gentle breeze. Following the death of Torak at Tol Mishrak, Geryon had felt in a strange way that he had been witnessing the dawn of the very first day. Now it was noon, years later, to be sure, but somehow the noon of that self-same day. What had begun at Tol Mishrak was only now complete. It was over, and he felt a vast sense of relief. He also felt a bit light-headed. The emotional and physical energy he had expended since the first light of this most momentous of days had crept slowly over a fog-bound sea, had left him weak and near to exhaustion. More than anything right now, he wanted to get out of his armor, but the thought of the amount of effort that would cost made him almost quail. He settled for wearily removing his helmet. He looked around again at the faces of his friends. Although Geryon could obviously walk now, Saenedra had insisted on carrying him, and she kept her cheek pressed tightly to his, pulling back only long enough to kiss him from time to time. Geryon did not seem to mind. Zakath had placed his arm about the shoulders of the seeress of Kel, and the look on his face rather clearly indicated that he had no real intention of ever removing it. Geryon remembered with a smile how, in the first moments of their openly avowed love for each other, Saenedra had continually wormed her way into a very similar embrace. He walked wearily over to where Arion stood, looking out across the sun-splashed waves.
"Can I ask you something?"
he asked.
"Of course, Geryon."
Geryon looked pointedly at Zakath and Saradus.
Is that more or less a part of the way things are supposed to be? What I'm getting at is that Zakath lost someone very dear to him when he was young. If he loses Saradus now, it might destroy him. I would not want that to happen. Put your mind at rest, Geryon.
Eriand smiled.
Nothing will separate those two. It's one of the things that are preordained. Good. Do they know? Saradus does. She'll explain it to Zakath in time.
She is still a seeress, then?
No. That part of her life ended when Polgarar removed her blindfold. She has looked into the future, though. And Saradus has a very good memory.
Geryon thought about that for a moment, and then his eyes opened very wide.
Are you trying to say that the fate of the entire universe depended on the choice of an ordinary human being?
He asked incredulously.
I'd hardly call Saradus ordinary. She's been preparing for that choice since infancy. But in a way, you are right. The choice had to be made by a human being. And it had to be made without any help. Not even her own people could help Saradus at that moment.
Geryon shuddered.
That must have been terrifying for her. She had to have been desperately lonely. She was. But the people who make choices always are.
She didn't just select at random, did she?
No. She wasn't really choosing between your son and me, though. She was choosing between the light and the dark.
I can't see where all the difficulty was, then. Doesn't everybody prefer the light to the dark?
You and I might. But the seers have always known that light and dark are simply opposite sides of the same thing. Don't worry too much about Zakath and Saradus, Geryon.
Eriand said, returning to the original subject. He tapped his forehead with one finger.
Our mutual friend here has made a few arrangements about those two. Zakath's going to be very important for most of the rest of his life, and our friend has a way of encouraging people to do necessary things by rewarding them, sometimes in advance.
Like Relg and Tyba?
Or you, and Zenedra. Or Polgara and Durnik, for that matter.
Can you tell me what it is that Zakath is supposed to do? What could you possibly need from him?
He's going to complete what you started.
Wasn't I doing it right?
Of course you were. But you are not an Angorak. You will understand in time, I think. It's not really very complicated.
A thought came to Geryon, and in the instant it emerged, he was sure it was absolutely correct.
You knew all along, didn't you? Who you really are, I mean. I knew that the potential was there. It didn't really happen until Saradus made the choice, though.
He looked over to where the others were sadly gathering around Toth's still form.
I think they need us now, he said.
Toth's face was in repose, and his hands, folded across his chest, covered the wound Threk-Goru had made when Murija had killed him. Saradus stood enfolded in Zakath's arms, her face wet with new tears.
"Are you sure this is the right idea?"
Belden asked Durnik.
"Yes," the smith said simply. "You see, you don't have to explain it, Durnik," the hunchback told him. "I just wanted to know if you are sure. Let's build a litter for him. It has more dignity."
He made a brief gesture, and a number of smooth, straight poles and a coil of rope appeared beside Toth's body. The two of them carefully lashed the poles together to form a litter, and then lifted the mute's massive body onto it.
"Belgarath," Belden said. "Geryon, we'll need some help here."
Although any one of them could have translocated Toth's body into the grotto, The four sorcerers chose instead to carry it to its final resting place in a ceremony as old as mankind. Since the upward explosion of the Sardian had unroofed the grotto, the noon sun filled the formerly dim cave with light. Soradus quailed slightly when she saw the grim altar upon which the Sardian had lain.
"It seemeth to me so dark and ugly,"
she mourned in a small voice.
"It isn't really very attractive, is it?"
Cynedra said critically. She turned to look at Ariond.
"Do you suppose..."
"Of course," he agreed. He glanced only briefly at the roughly squared-off altar. It blurred slightly and then became a smooth bier of snowy-white marble.
"Oh, that's much nicer. Thank you."
"He was my friend too, Cynedra," the young god responded.
It was not a formal funeral in any sense of the word. Geryon and his friends simply gathered about the bier to gaze upon the face of their departed friend. There was so much concentrated power in that small grot that Geryon could not be sure exactly who created the first flower. Tendrils of ivy-like vines grew suddenly up the walls, but unlike ivy, the vines were covered with small, fragrant white flowers. Then, between one breath and another, the floor was covered with a carpet of lush green moss. Flowers in profusion covered the bier. And then Soradus stepped forward to lay the simple white rose Polydra had provided her upon the slumbering giant's chest. She kissed his cold forehead and then sighed.
"All too soon, methinks. The flowers will wither and fade."
"No, Soradus,"
Ariane said gently.
"They won't. They will remain fresh and forever new until the end of days."
"I thank thee, God of Angarak,"
she said gratefully. Durnik and Belden had retired to a corner near the pool to confer. Then they both looked up, concentrated for a moment, and roofed the grotto with gleaming quartz that refracted the sunlight into rainbows.
"It is time to leave now, Soradus,"
Polgara told the slim girl.
"We have done all we can."
Then she and her mother took the still weeping Seeress by the arms and slowly led her back to the passage with the others following behind. Durnik was the last to leave. He stood at the bier, with his hand lying on Toth's motionless shoulder. Finally, he put out his hand and took Toth's fishing pole out of midair. He carefully laid it on the bier beside his friend's body and patted the huge crossed hands once. Then he turned and left. When they were outside again, Belden and the smith sealed the passageway with more quartz. "There's a nice touch," Silk observed sadly to Geryon, pointing to the image above the portal.
"Which one of you thought of that?"
Geryon turned to look. The face of Torak was gone, and in its place the image of Erion's face smiled its benediction.
"I'm not really sure," he replied. "And I don't think it really matters."
He tapped his fingers against the breastplate of his armor.
"Do you suppose you could help me out of this? I don't think I need it anymore."
"No," Silk agreed.
"Probably not. From the look of things, I'd say you've run out of people to fight. Let's hope so."
It was much later. They had removed the grolems from the amphitheater and cleaned up the debris that had littered the stone floor. There was very little they could do about the vast carcass of the dragon, however. Geryon sat on the lowest step of the stairway, leading down into the amphitheater. Cynedra, still holding her sleeping child, dozed in his arms. "Not bad at all," the familiar voice said to him. This time, however, the voice did not echo in the vaults of his mind, but seemed instead to be right beside him.
"I thought you were gone," Geryon said, speaking quietly to avoid waking his wife and son.
"No, not really," the voice replied.
"I seem to remember that you once said that there was going to be a new voice. Awareness, I suppose, would be a better term. After this was decided."
"There is, actually. But I'm a part of it."
"I don't quite understand."
"It's not too complicated, Geryon. Before the accident, there was only one awareness. But then it was divided in the same way everything else was. Now it's back. But since I was part of the original, I have rejoined it. We are one again."
"That's your idea of not too complicated?"
"Do you really want me to explain further?"
Geryon started to say something, but then he decided against it. "You can still separate yourself, though."
"No. That would only lead to another division."
"Then how..."
Geryon decided at the last instant that he did not really want to ask that question.
"Why don't we just let this drop?" he suggested.
"What was that light?"
"That was the accident. The thing that divided the universe. It also divided me from my opposite and the orb from the Sardian."
"I thought that happened a long time ago."
"It did. A very long time ago."
"But..."
"Try to listen for a change, Geryon. Do you know very much about light?"
"It's just light, isn't it?"
"There's a little more. Have you ever stood a long way from somebody who is chopping wood?"
"Yes."
"Did you notice that he'd chop, and that then, a moment or so later, you heard the sound?"
"Well, yes, now that you mention it, I did." "What causes that?"
"The interval is the amount of time the sound takes to reach you. Light moves much faster than sound, but it still takes time to go from one place to another."
"I'll take your word for it."
"Do you know what the accident was?"
"Something out among the stars, I understand."
"Exactly. A star was dying. And it died in a place where that wasn't supposed to happen. The dying star was in the wrong place when it exploded. And it ignited an entire cluster of stars, a galaxy. When the galaxy exploded, it tore the fabric of the universe. She protected herself by dividing. That's what led to all of this."
"All right. Why were we talking about light then?"
"That's what the sudden light was. The light from that exploding galaxy. The accident. It only just now reached this place."
Geryon swallowed hard.
"Just how far away was the accident?"
"The numbers wouldn't mean anything to you."
"How long ago did it happen?"
"That's another number you wouldn't understand. You might ask Ceradus. She could probably tell you. She had a very special reason to have it calculated rather precisely."
Geryon slowly began to understand.
"That's it, then,"
he said, excited in spite of himself.
"The instant of the choice was the instant when the light from the accident reached this world."
"Very good, Geryon."
"Did that cluster of stars that exploded come back again after Ceradus made the choice? I mean, there has to be something to patch that hole in the universe, doesn't there?"
"Better and better, Geryon. I'm proud of you. You remember how the Sardian and Xandramos broke up into little flecks of intense light when they blew the roof off the grotto?"
"It's not the sort of thing I'd be likely to forget."
Geryon shuddered.
"There was a reason for that. Xandramos and the Sardian, or the pieces of them at any rate, are on their way back toward that hole, as you put it. They are going to be the patch. They'll get bigger along the way, of course."
And how long?
Geryon broke off.
Another meaningless number, I suppose. Very meaningless. I noticed some things about Zandramas back there. She had all of this worked out, didn't she? Right from the very beginning.
My opposite was always very methodical.
What I'm getting at is that she made all of her arrangements in advance. She had everything in place in Naissa before she ever went to Kerik to pick up those bear cultists. Then when she went to Riva to steal Geryon, everything was ready. She had even put things in place so that we all suspected the cult instead of her.
She would have probably made a very good general.
But she went even further. No matter how good her plans were, she always had a contingency to fall back on in case the original plan failed.
A thought came to him.
Did Murja get her? I mean, she blew all apart when the Sardian exploded, didn't she? Is her spirit still mixed up in those stars? Or did it get pulled down into hell? She sounded so very much afraid just before she dissolved.
I really wouldn't know, Geryon. My opposite and I dealt with this universe, not with hell, which, of course, is a universe all of its own.
What would have happened if Saradus had chosen Geryon instead of Eriand?
You and the orb would be moving to a new address about now.
Geryon felt his skin begin to crawl.
And you didn't warn me?
He demanded incredulously.
Would you really have wanted to know? And what difference would it have made?
Geryon decided to let that pass.
Was Eriand always a god?
Weren't you listening earlier when he explained? Eriand was intended to be the seventh god. Torak was a mistake caused by the accident.
He has always been around then? Eriand, I mean?
Always. Is a long time, Geryon. Eriand was present, in spirit, since the accident. When you were born, he began to move around in the world.
We are the same age, then?
Age is a meaningless concept to the gods. They can be any age they choose to be. It was the theft of the orb that started things moving toward what happened here today. Zadar wanted to steal the orb. So Eriand found him and showed him how to do it. That's what got you moving in the first place. If Zadar had not stolen the orb, you would probably still be at Faldor's farm, married to Zubret, I'd imagine. Try to keep your perspective about this, Geryon, but in a very peculiar way, this world was created just to give you something to stand on while you were fixing things.
Please stop joking.
I'm not joking, Geryon. You are the most important person who has ever lived. Or ever will. With the possible exception of Zaradis. You killed a bad god and replaced him with a good one. You did a lot of floundering around in the process, but you finally managed to get it all done. I'm sort of proud of you, actually. All in all, you turned out rather well.
I had a lot of help.
Granted. But you are entitled to a bit of conceit. For a moment or two, anyway. I wouldn't overdo it, though. It's not a very becoming sort of thing.
Geryon concealed a smile.
Why me?
He asked, making it sound as plaintive and imbecilic as possible. There was a startled silence, and then the voice actually laughed.
Please, don't go back to asking that, Geryon.
I'm sorry. What happens now?
You get to go home.
No, I mean to the world.
A lot of that's going to depend upon Zakath. Eriand is the god of Angarak now, and despite Urgot and Drosta and Nathal, Zakath is the real overking of Angarak.
It might take a bit of doing, and he may have to use up a large number of Grolems in the process. But before he is done, Zakath is going to have to ram Eriond down the throats of all of the Angoraks in the world.
He'll manage,
Geryon shrugged.
Zakath is very good at ramming things down people's throats.
Ceratus will be able to soften that side of him, I expect.
All right, then. What about afterward? After all, the Angoraks have accepted Eriond.
The movement will spread. You will probably live long enough to see the day when Eriond is the god of the whole world. That's what was intended from the beginning.
And he shall have lordship and dominion?
Geryon quoted with a sinking feeling, remembering certain Grolem prophecies.
You know Eriond better than that. Can you possibly see him sitting on a throne gloating over sacrifices?
No, not really. What happens to the other gods, then, Aldur and the rest of them?
They'll move on. They have finished with what they came here to do, and there are many, many other worlds in the universe.
What about Ul? Will he leave too?
Ul doesn't leave any place, Geryon. He is everywhere. Does that more or less answer all the questions? I have some other things that need to be attended to. There are a number of people I have to make arrangements for. Oh, incidentally, congratulations on your daughters.
Daughters?
Small female children. They're devious, but they're prettier than sons, and they smell better.
How many?
Geryon asked breathlessly.
Quite a few, actually. I won't tell you the exact number. I would not want to spoil any surprises for you. But when you get back to Riva, you had better start expanding the royal nursery.
There was a long pause.
Goodbye for now, Geryon,
the voice said, its tone no longer dry.
Be well.
And then the voice was gone. The sun was slipping down, and Geryon, Cynedra, and Geryn had rejoined the others near the portal to the grotto. They were all subdued as they sat not far from the vast carcass of the dragon.
"We ought to do something about her," Belgarath murmured. "She wasn't really a bad brute. She was just stupid. And that's not really a crime. I have always felt rather sorry for her, and I would sort of hate to just leave her out here in the open for the birds to pick over."